Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. Bringing together some 60 paintings drawn from collections around the world, Cézanne Portraits is the first exhibition devoted exclusively to this often neglected area of Paul Cézanne's work. To celebrate the exhibition's opening on March 25, 2018, Mary Morton introduces the pictorial and thematic characteristics of Cézanne's portraits, the chronological development of his style and method, and the range and influence of his sitters. Issues of resemblance and identity are addressed across groupings of particular great portraits, which mutually inform each other to reveal arguably the most personal, because most human, aspect of his art. The National Gallery of Art is the sole American venue for Cézanne Portraits, which is on view through July 1st, 2018.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm so glad to have you here this afternoon. I am Mary Morton, curator of French paintings here at the National Gallery of Art. And I am, I am honored, frankly, to be able to spend the next hour to talk about, you know, arguably one of the greatest painters that ever lived in this particular genre. And it's an exhibition that, in a way, features. There are roughly 60 pictures in the show, but our boy in a red waistcoat is arguably the masterpiece of the exhibition. He's on the cover of the catalog. The exhibition actually opened at the Musée d'Orsay in Paris last summer, and there he is on the Paris Metro, looking really good. The exhibition then moved to the National Portrait Gallery in London, and here he is on the Tube. And now he is home and happily in the Mellon Exhibition Galleries in the West Building, which I think are, I have said this before, the greatest galleries for oil painting pretty much anywhere. And I would say that the exhibition was spectacular at the Orsay. And it looked great in London. I think it was proclaimed by one of the rags there as the show of the year. But it is transformed in our galleries. It's the conditions of light, the proportions, it just looks fantastic. So I know you're gonna enjoy it if you haven't seen it already this morning. It is the first major museum exhibition to be devoted exclusively to Cézanne's achievement in this traditional genre of portraiture. So most people, when they think of Cézanne, think of still life paintings, apples and pears and the ginger jar, or they think of the landscapes of Aix-en-Provence, images of Mont Saint-Victoire, paintings which transformed the history of art. You simply would not have had the modernism of Matisse and Picasso and so many other 20th century artists without Cézanne. So what happens when this great formalist master has before him not inanimate objects arrayed on a table or views of canyons and mountains, and instead has a human being, in almost every case someone he knew quite well, his wife, his son, his friends, his neighbors, himself? How does this affect his famous process? This is the drama of the exhibition. So in an oeuvre of about 1,000 paintings that Cézanne produced across his life, less than 200, roughly 160, are portraits. They do count among his earliest works. Just a little bit of backstory on the project. It was actually born, the seed for the show, in the summer of 2007 by Philip Conespy, who was the head of French paintings at the time here at the gallery. He was on a fellowship at the Clark Art Institute with Sandy Nairn, who was the then director of the National Portrait Gallery. And as you may recall, if you saw Philip's great Cézanne and X show, Philip was a Cézanne fanatic. And Sandy Nairn was very ambitious for to do major shows at the National Portrait Gallery in London. So they decided to do this show, which had never been done before, a museum exhibition treatment of Cézanne's portraits. Sadly, Philip got sick and passed away about 6 months later. And Sandy circled around in New York and invited John Elderfield, who is the chief curator emeritus from the Museum of Modern Art, to be the exhibition curator, That was in 2009. I arrived here in 2010. They came to me, and of course we jumped all over the opportunity to participate. The exhibition, as conceived by John, is organized roughly in groups and clusters, sort of basically chronological, but it's about particular sitters that Cezanne approaches across canvases, or particular formal challenges that he deals with across different sitters. And what I'd like to do today is focus on some of the highlights of the show, look at a couple of carefully considered clusters. And what I'm going to try and do is really drill down on these pictures and, you know, how they work, which is very difficult to do. I'll get to that a little bit later. I would say that in writing the catalog, both John Elderfield and I, as we described these paintings, were somewhat surprised at the degree to which issues of emotional and psychological affect crept into our sort of more formal descriptions. And I did want to say that John Elderfield will circle back on June 3rd and give a lecture related to the exhibition, so I hope you can come back for that. The exhibition opens with a spectacular wall of portraits of the same man. He is the brother of Cezanne's mother. His name was Uncle Dominic. These are portraits that were done in Aix, when Cezanne is just starting out as a painter in the 1860s. Applied with heavily loaded brushes and with the palette knife, most spectacularly and shockingly. The palette knife is a little trowel-like tool that painters would use to mix pigment on the palette, but never apply pigment to the canvas surface. It's just too rough and crude of a tool. Painters reserved that practice for a range of sizes and various strengths of brushes. But here, Cezanne is using the palette knife, signaling in doing this the realist master Gustave Courbet, whose radically original manipulation of paint, particularly in his landscape painting in the 1860s, defied the cool refinement of the academic, what was called the fini, which is the finish, the sort of respectable level of finish that a painter would achieve before exhibiting a work or selling a work. Courbet invented new expressive possibilities through a very physical engagement with paint on the picture surface. Cezanne called this style his manière couillarde, or ballsy manner. It was stylistically in line with a persona that was equally encouraged by that of Courbet, the wild-haired, rough-hewn provincial who descends on Paris cursing in a heavy regional accent. As did Courbet in the 1850s, Cezanne's scruffy beard, his working-class clothes, and crude language established a bohemian position against urbane bourgeois propriety and the academic fini that it embodied. The vigorously worked surface of these paintings moves well beyond those of Courbet's landscapes, with areas in which the artist has smeared on pigment in thick slabs, leaving uneven edges with no representational function. Like Courbet, Cezanne used the knife to sculpt the paint once applied. But again, the effect here is coarser and more overtly gestural, and it covers most of the canvas. Featured in the second gallery is this marvelous portrait of Cezanne's father, Louis-Auguste Cezanne. This is a painting that belongs to the National Gallery of Art. Paul Mellon bought it and gave it to us. We had it for about a year in the conservation studio, where Michael Swicklick painstakingly cleaned it. You can imagine how difficult that was, given the scale and the thickness of the paint surface. But he looks fantastic. He's hanging on his own baffle, and I think it's one of the show highlights. The artist's father, Louis-Auguste Cezanne, was the only surviving son of Italian immigrants, and he grew up in the south of France, in the department of Var, in Provence. He began a business with a partner in Aix, selling hats, and he made enough money to buy a bank in 1848 and became one of the richest men in town. Paul was his only son, and of course he wanted his son to grow up and establish himself at the social and economic level that the father had achieved. He had Paul classically educated, which is to say that he studied ancient Greek and Latin, Paul seems actually to have been a gifted Latinist. He won several prizes, school prizes, for his excellence in Latin. His father wanted him to go to law school, which did not interest Paul in the slightest. Paul wore him down, however, and by the mid-1860s, Paul was moving back and forth to Paris, training as a professional artist with an allowance from his father. He doesn't enter into the École des Beaux-Arts, but rather he studies in a series of private teaching studios, these private places where the young painters who would become known as the Impressionists were gathering. So he met most of them then in these painting studios. And what these guys are doing to become professional artists is basically preparing works for submission to the big annual public exhibition known as the Salon. It was the only way at the time to become known and to have a career. So this successful financier, decisive and by all accounts imposing, is portrayed here on a monumental scale as an assured, informed man of business, relaxing at home in slippers and cap, reading the paper, quote, like a pope on his throne in a big armchair, as one friend put it. Paul weaves himself into this iconic image of domestic masculinity with the inclusion on the wall behind his father of one of his first still life paintings, done in his radical Manière Couillard. The confident application of paint with a palette knife and heavily loaded brushes constitutes a kind of painterly swagger, in part perhaps to reassure his father of the strength and audacity of his vision. Cézanne has pulled back from the sitter to a respectful distance and averts a direct gaze. It is a powerful, compact painting, the figure wholly contained and securely anchored by the armchair and framed still life. The public address of the painting is signified not only by its distinguished scale, aggressive facture, and dramatic contrasts of light and dark, but also by a very specific reference to contemporary culture. Louis Auguste is absorbed there in the pages of a newspaper called L'Evénement. You can read it there upside down in the masthead. It was a short-lived journal that had launched the previous year, and in which his best friend growing up, Émile Zola, who would become the most famous novelist of the latter part of the 19th century, Zola was also an art critic, and published in this newspaper his famous defense of those painters that had been refused at the recent Salon of 1866. Championing Manet and Cézanne in particular, Zola used the opportunity to indict official art policies and the academic painting that it supported. So this muscular picture can be seen as something of a personal and public manifesto, an homage to paternal and fraternal support and to the new painting, as it was known. One of the paintings that was refused by the Salon jury, prompting Zola's complaint, was Cézanne's 1866 portrait of his close friend and fellow Aixois, Anthony Vallebregue, that I'm showing you on the left, also a National Gallery picture. Vallebregue was a member of a local band of ambitious young artists and writers that included Zola. He was from a well-respected Jewish family with roots in Provence dating back generations. He planned to be a writer and a critic in Paris, and he, like Paul Cézanne, was encouraged by Zola to come and take the capital by storm. Both writer and painter were in Paris in the spring of 1866, which is the likely date of the National Gallery portrait. Vallebregue is portrayed there in a three-quarter view, sitting stiffly with his hands clenched into fists against his thighs. His closed mouth is set tightly, and his brow looks furrowed. Strokes of lurid red mark the lips and the tip of the nose and flicker around the eyes, set off by a generous use of black in the central features of his face, in his hair, and in his jacket. The image projects a tone of resistance and resolve. Although the pose is conventional, and Vallebregue wears a generic middle-class suit, his truculent tone, and most spectacularly, the overall thick paint surface applied with heavily loaded brushes and with the palette knife, would have struck the intended audience, the Salon jury, like a slap in the face. Vallebreg had predicted a negative response from the Salon jury to this fierce picture, writing in a letter to a friend in X, quote, "Paul will without doubt be rejected at the exhibition. A Philistine in the jury exclaimed on seeing my portrait that it was not only painted with a knife, but with a pistol as well." Cézanne, I want to show you the painting on the right in this pair. He circles back to Vallebreg again several years later in this painting from roughly 69 to 71, which comes from the Getty Museum. It's about half the size of the picture, just his head and shoulders, and it is less formal, certainly, in format. The sitter seems more relaxed, tilting his head to the side. His tousled jacket, his hair is tousled, his jacket is open, and his expression is looser. The thickness of the paint, though, links the picture to the earlier version. Each individual stroke is visible, carefully placed, one imagines, with constant reference to the sitter. More brush than knife, overall the painting has a more refined surface and than that of the earlier version, perhaps the influence of several more years in the competitive arena of Parisian painting. Spread throughout the show are these marvelous self-portraits in which Cézanne deals with his own self-image almost as obsessively as Rembrandt. The painting on the upper left is the one I wanted to talk specifically about. It shows him, it's sort of a classic impressionist Cézanne, and that he's sitting in the studio of his friend Armand Guillaumin. And behind Cézanne's head, you see in reverse a major painting by Guillaumin, a cityscape of the quay along the Seine. You can make out the river and the towers of Notre Dame up above his head. His hair is unruly. The dome of his head is vigorously sculpted. His eyebrows are arched, his eyes piercing, while his mouth is obliterated by a bushy mustache and beard. There's a kind of electric energy, a sort of wildness and roughness, both in the way that he is presenting himself and in how he paints. The variety of touch, the range and size of directed strokes, and his refusal to finish in a neat and resolved way, certainly according to academic Moores. The painting in the center has grown on me in the 3 weeks that we've had the show up. It's a fascinating picture, particularly in the color of that background. He almost looks backlit. And then the painting on the right is a tiny painting. It shows Cézanne's brilliance at painting on a very small scale with an intensity that practically knocks you down. It's sort of a perfect painting. It comes from the National Gallery in London. Victor Choquet holds a singular position in Cézanne's artistic biography, both as his most avid collector and as an aesthetic soulmate. Choquet and Cézanne shared a particular love for the works of Courbet and the leader of Romanticism, Eugène Delacroix. Renoir had introduced them at the 1875 auction, the Impressionist auction at the Hôtel Drouot. Choquet bought his first Cézanne in October of that year. He was a customs official by profession. He was not a man of great means, but he was able to satisfy his collecting habit through a careful selection of drawings and paintings, as well as furniture, silver, porcelain, and other objets d'art. And he was devoted to the Impressionists, fully convinced by the new painting, as Impressionism was known, and offering financial and moral support in the difficult early years of the movement. In the catalog of the 1876 Impressionist exhibition, which was the second show, he was listed as the owner of works by Monet and Pizarro and some six paintings by Renoir. At the 1877 Impressionist exhibition, Cézanne displayed a portrait of his friend, the picture on the left, a head study, with the sitter looking to his left, his collar open, and his thick mane of gray-streaked hair brushed off his high forehead. The painting drew a vicious critical response. The sitter was deemed a maniac, or sick, or a criminal. Here, one critic wailed, is a painting by a crazy man of a crazy man. Louis Loire, who was a well-known ridiculer of the Impressionists, warned potential visitors that this head, the color of the underside of boots, so strange, could be a danger to the unborn children of pregnant women. While the overtly casual presentation of a somewhat unkempt-looking Choquet may have been a little startling, it was likely the paint surface that so strongly offended viewers. Thick strokes of barely mixed pigment are layered densely across the surface, creating a rough-hewn effect. To the contemporary eye that was used to refined modulations of volume and delicate evocations of dignified sitters, the portrait must have been quite jarring. Although painted around the same time, the Columbus portrait on the right is quite different, perhaps even a response to the criticism of the head study. The sitter has been pushed back from the picture plane so that the frame fully encapsulates his compact seated body. In his apartment on the Rue de Rivoli, Choquet sits in a Louis XIV armchair, having turned away from an antique desk to pose, gazing steadily at the painter. He's anchored by the gilded frames of the paintings hanging behind him. The sitter's interlaced fingers, crossed legs, and frontally posed torso and head underline the coherent balance of the picture, while the glowing red of the lozenges in the wallpaper, in the upholstery, and in the patterns of the rug maintain the painting's vibrancy. Here, Cézanne advances a new idea of pictorial unity, in which the surface is carefully built up into a pattern of constructive strokes. German art historian Julius Meiergräfe likened it to a stonemason's construction. Attributing the meditative intensity of the process to the unusual communion between painter and collector, he continued, quote, "The mental atmosphere of the sitter, who was a peculiar individual, became plastically intelligible in Cézanne's portrait." Cézanne's dealer, Amboise Vollard, recounts that Cézanne hated being watched at his easel, a fact that obviously complicated the artist's portrait practice. Additionally challenging was the artist's perquisite of extreme patience from his sitters in repeated and prolonged sittings, during which they were urged not to move or speak. Because the practice was so important to him, though, he forged on, mostly painting people with whom he was very comfortable, and whom, out of love, respect, loyalty, or remuneration, would perform the kind of patience that he required, among whom counted, of course, his partner and eventual wife, Hortense Fiquet, whom he painted at least 27 times. The two had met in 1869 in Paris. Hortense was 19, Cézanne was 30. She was a bookbinder. She sewed the bindings of books and apparently an occasional model, which is probably how they met. They started living together. They had a son, Paul, in 1872, but Cézanne kept her hidden from his family and particularly from his father. Again, he was living on his father's allowance, and one supposes that Cézanne felt she may not have been accepted or presentable as a partner for him to his family. And so, in fact, he doesn't marry her until Paul, the boy, is almost 14 years old. The portraits of Fiquet in the Boston on the left and the Stockholm paintings are among the earliest portraits that he does of her. They were done in Paris in the apartment that he shared with her and their son. On the Rue de l'Ouest, he was in that apartment from the fall of 1876 to the spring of 1879. Crucially for Cézanne, Fiquet was not Parisian, but like himself, she was from the provinces, brought to the city by her parents to make a living. She succumbed to the Parisian fashion craze, and perhaps transferring her skills as a bookbinder to personal dressmaking presumably made some of the sartorial confections found in the painted portraits. In the Boston painting, on the left, she wears a robe de promenade in blue, festooned with ribbons and a shimmering striped skirt. The dress so stimulated Cézanne that through describing its forms, textures, and colors, he surpassed not only his own previous work, but created a milestone in the history of painting. How to account for this stunning painting, a breakthrough picture, as one art historian has it? The artist was clearly entranced as he called the figure forth on the canvas. For Cézanne, such an achievement required a purity and intensity of presence on the part of the sitter, and a powerful rapport between sitter and artist, a condition seemingly fulfilled by Fiquet. She sits in a high-backed, stuffed red armchair at a comfortable distance from the picture plane, gazing steadily at the painter. Her face is modeled by flat planes of color that sculpt the forms of her brow, the bridge of her nose, her cheekbones. In her dress, Cézanne unleashes a sumptuous array of liquid blue and green, purple and mauve, turquoise, gray, and taupe patches, amplified, all of them, by the glowing red upholstery of the armchair. Her right side is firmly frontal in presentation, while her left relaxes into an opening up and curving armchair, the brushstrokes in the skirt loosening as it falls. There's a dignity, an extraordinary monumentality to the figure. She is a, quote, regal presence on her great red throne, such that the painting in memory always seems much larger than it is. The poet Rainier Maria Rilke's response, who saw the painting at the Salon d'Automne in 1907, at Cézanne's sort of commemorative retrospective, returns to his hotel and writes a letter, now famous, to his wife that suggests the emotional power of the picture. He writes, "In my feelings, the consciousness of her presence has grown into an exaltation, which I perceive even in my sleep. My blood describes her to me, but the verbal expression passes by somewhere outside and will not be called in." And I'm going to use that as a cue to relay once again, not to give myself an out, but these paintings are extraordinarily difficult to translate into words. They are all about, you know, standing in front of them and allowing them to have an effect on you. But then the task, if you were to account for it verbally, is super difficult. But we're trying, we're trying. I find that the best people that write about Cézanne do tend to be poets, people with an extraordinary control of language. The Boston Madame Cézanne is a major masterpiece, obviously. It also disrupts this genre of painting, which portraiture was under critical fire during these years. Both the over-proliferation of portraiture, which really was taking over the walls of the salon, and the burgeoning business of portrait photography put pressure on the aesthetic claims of the genre. Cézanne here displaces the expressive power of the portrait from traditional notions of likeness and identifiable identity to the overall design of the picture and, above all, to the abstract pleasures of color. It's wonderful to have a second painting clearly from the same moment of Madame Cézanne in the same dress, sitting in the same corner of the apartment, but quite different. It comes from Stockholm. It is more square in format. It has a more staid interior effect. The palette is more subdued. The blue-red cord of her dress against the armchair is uncomplicated by the prismatic patches of the Boston version. Fiquet focuses downward on her stitching, her neatly coiffed bun and angular facial features suggesting domestic precision. Cézanne has shifted the location of the broad-backed chair so that it spans or blocks the door, the brown knob and lock hovering beside her head. If these paintings emit a peaceful radiance, indeed the life of Cézanne's family during these years was relatively easy. They lived off of Cézanne's allowance from his father, which would be secure until the spring of 1878, when, in a letter posted to Paul in Aix by Choquet and opened by his father by accident, in that letter the reference to Madame Cézanne et petit Paul exposed the son's deceit. Family life would become more transient and turbulent, a fraying captured in later portraits. After a decade and a half living off of her husband's allowance and occasional loans from his friends and constantly moving between apartments in Paris and back and forth to the south of France, in the later 1880s, Hortense Fiquet did experience some domestic stability. Although he'd been referring to her as his wife and Madame Cézanne for over a decade, Cézanne finally acknowledged their union publicly, marrying her in Aix in 1886. His father passed away several months later, leaving his inheritance. But years of living in the shadows with her son, stashed in Marseille, while Cézanne visited his father and sister at the family estate in which was known as the Jas de Buffon, or visiting his mother in her house in Lestac, or Madame Cézanne and Paul remained alone in Paris, while he visited friends and painted in various locations in northern France sur le motif. All of this had surely taken their toll on their relationship. Even after they were made a legal couple, Cézanne rented a place for Fiquet and Paul in Aix, while remaining himself with his mother and sister at the Jas. He would take care of her and seemed to want her nearby, but could not seem to bring himself to live with her. These three pictures exude an emotional character that corresponds to what we know about the sitter and her life. She seems sullen, dislocated, and melancholic. One senses the expression not only of Fiquet's emotional self-presentation to the painter, but also Cézanne's own profound comprehension of her plight. His complicity in and identity with her latent anguish underlies the effects of these images. Cézanne's refusal to make the gestures traditional to the genre of female portraiture unleashed one of the more startling strains of misogyny in art history. Writers regret that she was not more beautiful, beauty being the historical arbiter of a female sitter's worthiness of artistic attention. And her refusal to ingratiate, to offer a pleasing expression, damned her in critics' eyes. One writer inferred from her impassivity a, quote, stunned stupidity. Another blamed, quote, that sour-looking bitch for what he perceived as the artist's repression. Dumb, mean, unsupportive, and irrelevant, the dehumanization and villainization of Hortense is generic to the Cézanne literature. Indeed, these three portraits of Fiquet in a blue dress are among the toughest. Her hair is pulled back severely, which defeminizes her in a way that most of the other portraits with even a glimpse of her top knot do not. The most austere is the one in the center, which comes from the Musée d'Orsay. It is a head study. It was, interestingly, owned during the first half of the 20th century by Henri Matisse. It is the most abstract, with the elegant understatement and polish of a Brancusi sculpture. Her sparse head is simplified to include only one ear, which serves to balance the composition. Cézanne turns her head slightly off frontal axis, disaligning her sharp hair part from the seam in the wall behind and echoing her profile in the suggestion of faint lozenges in the wallpaper to her right. The thinness of the paint surface, with evidence of graphite underdrawing across her face, and the smaller dimensions mark this as a study for the Houston and or Detroit paintings on either side. In the Houston painting, on the left, her face is turned wholly towards the painter, whom she engages with a direct gaze in a pose of obdurate frontality, as one critic put it. Her left ear is seen in profile, however, and her head breaks free from alignment with the wall seam behind her and with the strongly sculpted pedestal of her neck. The decorative shapes of the brown sideboard and wallpaper to her right animate the background, advancing menacingly towards the sitter until the composition opens up again into luminous, cool tones lightly brushed into the verticals and horizontals of the wall molding. The painting succeeds in offering a convincing presence even as the image dissolves into illegibility and abstract marks on the canvas. Larger, in fact, largest of all, is the painting on the right that comes from the collection in Detroit. He has her posed against the same wallpaper, but she's backed by a curtain. Cézanne is pulled further back to include her lap and folded hands. The entangled thumbs and index fingers of her clasped hands feel tentative, as if their reach is not quite afforded by her short arms. Her nose is more hooked, and her mouth is pulled into something of a pout. It feels as if Cézanne has gotten as far as he could with this ambitiously scaled painting and then stops, leaves it, moves on to something else. Let's move on to what is really one of the highlights of the exhibition, the wall that I call the hot wall, which is the series of four paintings of Cézanne in a red dress. They come from Switzerland, São Paulo, Brazil, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and Chicago, and it's just great to have them all together. Clearly, there is a serial nature to this project of Cézanne's, and it's dramatically on evidence here. You see Cézanne freeing himself from traditional methods of representation, the application of perspectival systems, of preconceived systems, of mathematical linear perspective, the rational charting of space from a static point of view. This is the way that painting operated for 200 years. And he's freeing himself across these four pictures to something more experimental, guided by intense looking and then a lifelong practice of recording perception, what he called his sensations in strokes on the canvas. The result that you get from this practice is an intensity, an extreme presentness that is more faithful to the perceptual chaos, arguably, of raw sensation and to the ambiguity and instability of perception than that which you could learn in the academy. John Elderfield writes beautifully on this sequence in the book. They're very complicated pictures. I would say that the sort of culmination is the picture on the third from the left, from the Metropolitan Museum of Art, which is just a staggering piece, very large. Again, takes time to sort of make sense of. The boy in the red waistcoat. So this, again, is the highlight of the exhibition, and it's been wonderful to excavate him by looking very carefully at three preceding versions of iterations of this boy. This is a model, a young Italian living in Paris, who was used by other artists in the late 1880s as a model. He's about 17 years old, and he is pictured here in a painting of the projection here. In fact, only the painting on the far left is included in the exhibition. Ideally, we would have had all four. But the painting on the far left lives in the Birla Foundation in Switzerland, and they don't lend to the United States. The painting in the center you may recognize from the Barnes Foundation. They don't lend. The painting on the far left belonged to David Rockefeller, who certainly in his final years was not lending his works. He wanted to have them all around. He passed away about a year ago and left the picture to MoMA. So John Elderfield and I waited as long as we felt was graceful and rushed in and asked him if we could have the picture for the show, and he absolutely supported us. So it's marvelous to have the painting on the left. All of them, I would argue, are meditations on male adolescence. In the Birla picture, the boy's face is quite small, his ears are large, his arm is impossibly long, and he's sort of hunched over in a meditative pose. The painting in the center from the Barnes, he looks like a child with his ears, his bowed ears holding back his hair, and his fine features sort of slumped down. And then the painting on the far left from David Rockefeller, his hands, again, are larger than the rest of his body, and he has a little bit of a shadow on his lip. And then the culmination of all of these pictures is our painting, clearly inspired by examples of 16th century Florentine painting, Bronzino and Pontormo, who made famous portraits of young male adolescents in the city of Florence. He strikes a classical pose called contrapposto, in which with the cocked hips, the symmetry of the body, of the shoulders and the hips and the knees, becomes slightly askew and creates a sense of liveliness and even movement. He is wearing a crisp circular hat, beneath which the pretty features of a boy's face appear. But then as you move down his body, you recognize a much more sort of manly swagger in the chaps and the Italian vest. I think it is of the four certainly the most successful in its ambition and an absolute miracle of painting. It was Paul Mellon's favorite painting. It is my favorite painting here at the National Gallery, so I hope you will spend some time with this work. Cézanne basically stopped shuttling back and forth to Paris around the late 1880s, early 1890s, and lived essentially in exile in Aix. He disdained Paris and the Parisians, this sort of decadent culture that he felt had taken over the capital city. Decadent in its commercialism, in its bourgeoisification, in what he felt to be a very insincere mode of socializing. And he was much more comfortable and happy in Aix, where he felt that the classical origins of the landscape the sort of authenticity of the people that lived there, their proximity to nature and to earth and to manual labor, kept them in a realm of humanity that he really respected and loved. And so he spent the last 20 years of his life mostly painting the people of Aix, domestic servants, these guys who hung out at the local cafe that Cézanne frequented. They would come together in five spectacular masterpieces known as the Card Players series. But here we've broken them off, and we are arguing that they appear as virtual portraits. The painting on the left comes from the Courtauld Art Institute, and he is, again, placed very centrally in the composition. And he wears a sort of a cowboy hat. He has the kind of presence and authority and dignity that we find contemporarily in the Marlborough man. He's like a real man of the South. And the painting on the left comes from the Kunsthalle in Mannheim. Just a kind of dignity and heroization of portraying these guys just sort of as they were. They are utterly unperformative in their poses. They are undramatic. They are just themselves, and Cézanne is recording them. In 1895, Cézanne's dealer Vollard has a one-man show in Paris, and Cézanne really had disappeared from the scene. He hadn't shown in Paris since 1882. And people, frankly, were surprised that he was still alive when this show happens. He ships his paintings up. He doesn't go up to Paris, but he ships about 100 pictures up to Paris, and Vollard has a one-man show. It is a staggering moment for the young painters. Vollard would traffic in, it's known that roughly two-thirds of Cézanne's output would pass through Vollard's hands. That's how central he was to the oeuvre. I mean, he was the first one that discovers Cézanne, and he basically buys up everything that's in Cézanne's studio and works with young Paul to sell Cézanne's work over the next decades. In 1914, he writes a wonderful sort of celebrity memoir about Cézanne. And in it, there's a marvelous iteration, a sort of account of what it was like to sit for this portrait, which Cézanne does in 1899. And Vollard claims that he sat for 115 times, that they would start at 8:30 in the morning and end at 11 p.m., that Cézanne would sit in front of him and put one stroke, and then 20 minutes later, put another stroke, and that this would sort of go on. And then Vollard would go home, go to bed, and when he came back in the morning, the painting would have been completely redone. So it was very frustrating, very arduous. Cézanne ultimately was dissatisfied with this painting and claimed that it was unfinished. But when you look at it in the galleries, you'll see how thick the surface is, particularly in the contours, as he tries to, you know, wrestle with this image. It's a fantastic work, but Cézanne was dissatisfied. I'm showing you here two late works. The painting on the left comes from the Phillips collection across town, and in the Paris and London iterations of the exhibition, we had her hanging with another version of the same sitter done at the same time. That painting lives at the Hermitage in Russia. And as you may recall, Russia doesn't lend to the United States of America either since 2010. So we have her here on her own, and then this marvelous painting on the left from the Musée d'Orsay. The painting from the Phillips and the painting from the Hermitage show a sitter who is rather formally dressed for Cézanne's work in a tailored suit with triple puffed sleeves. It was a fashion in the late 1890s, which is one way that we date this picture. She wears a matching flower decorated hat that's worn high on her head. She may have been a housekeeper, but she's dressed a little bit formally. People used to think she was Hortense Fiquet, but I think that's unlikely. It has also been suggested and is perhaps more likely that she's Cézanne's sister, with whom he was very close across his life, named Marie, whose affluent and conservative social station more closely match the attire. The Phillips Collection picture is strikingly dark, not only in hue, but in effect. She reclines back in her chair, and her head is cocked back, perhaps resting against the wall. Her mouth is downturned, and the flesh sags from her cheekbones down around her jaw. The Orsay peasant, John Elderfield and I, had a really interesting sort of tension around the reading of this painting. We were battling it out over the wall text and how to talk about this picture. And I think John Elderfield, who again comes from the Museum of Modern Art, which is the bastion of a very sort of a devotion to abstraction across the 20th century, and the way in which artists verge towards abstraction through through geometry, the abstract forms of geometry. And you see how wonderful this evocation of this old man in the shape of a diamond, sort of perfectly with a cane running up a sort of central axis. The lozenges on the wallpaper behind, which reiterate his form. I can't help seeing this painting without thinking about it as a meditation on the effects of gravity over the course of 70 or 80 years on a body. The hands are extraordinary, and really look carefully at this in the galleries. They're gigantic. The ears are gigantic. The face is sort of small. The head is sort of small, and it just feels like it's, you know, again, it's a wonderful abstraction, but also, I think, extremely expressive. I wanted to conclude with these two paintings of the artist Vallier. The painting on the left belongs to us, to the National Gallery. The man Vallier was a gardener and a sort of handyman that helped Cézanne live, basically, in his garden and studio in Chemin de Loeuvre, which was his final residence for the last 7 years of his life. They are of equal dimensions and very similar composition. Again, one belongs to us and the other belongs to a private collection, so it's great to have them together. They look like exact copies. The only instance of such replication in Cézanne's oeuvre. The paint surface is inordinately thick, with Cézanne waiting for underlayers to fully dry before adding more. He cultivates an impacted look by dragging dry but loaded brushes across already dry paint, allowing understrata to remain visible. In some passages, paint gathers in lumps, such as at the sitter's temple. The literature on the Vallier pictures is consistently bedeviled by either vague philosophizing or a recitation of mundane details about Vallier and Cézanne's final days. Indeed, these pictures are among the least legible in Cézanne's oeuvre. As with most of Cézanne's portraits, he's largely displaced emotional expression from the conventional sight of the face to the formal elements of color, shape, composition, and touch. There is a tendency to see these paintings as a final statement, a last gasp from the artist before he dies. They're also read with unusually autobiographical references, a kind of conflation between this crusty old gardener and the increasingly cranky old painter. In fact, the letters from Cézanne's final years are riddled with ruminations on aging and death. And these paintings are quite moving when read as meditations on old age. There's something frightening and even foreboding to these encrusted images of Vallier, his face shadowed by the visor of his cap, cheeks sunken beneath his beard. His hands lay in his lap in a strange, gaping gesture, as if holding an illegible pipe or grasping something that has disappeared. They have an arduously labored look, and indeed there are accounts of Cézanne having started a portrait of Vallier as early as 1902 and working on one within days of his death in 1906. If his oeuvre was a lifelong struggle, one senses in this last group an artist with diminished energy and eyesight, but undiminished ambition, thrashing through the realization of his sensations to achieve something satisfying. In his own mind, however, success evaded him, and he died still trying. Thank you.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.